Welcome to Blocked and Reported. I'm Katie Herzog, and joining me today, while Jesse is hopefully putting the finishing touches on his book because he's coming back to work next week, we have Anna Kasparian. Anna is a writer, a journalist, a host, and a producer on The Young Turks, a news network you can watch online or on your TV. And I am so glad she's joining us today. Anna, welcome to Blocked and Reported.
Thank you for having me. This is easily my favorite podcast, and it's so cool to be here.
Wow. Yeah. That is shocking to hear. I don't think we're anyone's favorite podcast. We found the one. Definitely not mine.
Well, I mean, what better place to go if you want a deep dive on some of the most insane culture war garbage happening in the country?
If you like adult baby diver lovers, we are the place for you.
It's good. It's good. And it's just, you guys come at it in a fair and honest way, and that's kind of hard to find these days in the press. You know, you come across news articles or broadcasts where it's very clear that there's either an agenda or a side being taken, whereas you guys do your due diligence and you're fair to all sides involved, even if you have a take.
We try. I want to get into this, into the state of the media in a little bit, but we've got a great show planned today. In the second half of the show, you're going to tell me about a movement to ban police from doing traffic stops. I'm very excited and a little nervous to learn about that. But first, let's talk about you a little bit. So until fairly recently, my impression of you from The Young Turks and from following you on Twitter and from the company that I assumed you keep, and I apologize for this, but my impression of you was that you were pretty much a leftist woke scold. Mm-hmm. Certainly not the worst offender by any means. I searched your Twitter yesterday, and I was pleasantly surprised to find that you've never called anyone a TERF. But as part of my offense archaeology, I did find a tweet from 2022 that I think embodies the attitude I'm talking about and the attitude that I thought that you held. So this is in response to Glenn Greenwald. You tweeted, "If you or anyone you know is trans and slept with Joe Rogan, we'd like to know so we can understand why he's so obsessed with the trans community." And now it's 2024, and you've become very outspoken against identitarianism, and you're guest hosting a podcast for notorious trans baby killer Jesse Single. So my question for you, what the hell happens?
Well, I have gone through a bit of an evolution, or depending on who you talk to, something, a regression. But how it all started really had to do with something that I had experienced personally that had nothing to do with the transgender community. And the way the left reacted to what I experienced started opening my mind up to the possibility that maybe they're full of crap on certain things. And I started questioning a lot of things. So what sparked this change was a sexual assault that I experienced in my own neighborhood as I was walking my dog. Mm. I opened up about that experience on TYT and was pretty shocked at the reaction I got. You know, I'm opening up about something terrible that happened to me. You'd think you'd get a little bit of understanding or sympathy, but instead, since the person who carried out the sexual assault was homeless, I started getting called racist, which was kind of hilarious because I had never disclosed the race of the individual who actually happened to be white. Mm-hmm. They said that I was putting out propaganda against the homeless community when I was specifically talking about one event that I experienced. And so all of a sudden, the mask was off in regard to the side, the political side that resonated with me the most. And I just started to wonder about other narratives and other things that I kind of took at face value with the left. And then one day, it was definitely an impulse, and maybe I should have thought about it a little more before I did it. I had tweeted about how much I dislike phrases like birthing person or person with a uterus, mm-hmm. and I just specifically said I would like to be called a woman. And then all hell broke loose. Like, I could not believe it.
How dare you?
You know, it's not like I tweeted, "I refuse to respect your pronouns," or "I don't believe in transgender people having the ability to ever transition." Like, nothing like that. It was just about what I prefer. And all of the usual suspects got involved. Alejandra Caraballo, one of them, you know, just says that I'm against being inclusive. I'm a TERF. Which was also hilarious because I didn't know that I was even a radical feminist, but apparently I am.
Right.
So I just started seeing some behaviors on the far left that were similar to behaviors that you see on the far right. Now, their beliefs are different, but the way they behave is very similar. And I realized that I had been regurgitating certain talking points without even realizing I was doing it, to be honest with you. I was spreading this stuff as if it were fact without really questioning things. And then once I started questioning things, two things happened. I became a lot more uncomfortable at work and more uncomfortable covering stories in the way that I've been covering them, you know, over the last few years. But I also started to feel a lot happier in a lot of ways. Like in my personal life, I felt happier because I was able to look at my political opponents in a much more sober way. And instead of having this doomer mentality about people I disagree with, I decided, let me actually understand their arguments in good faith. And even though oftentimes I still disagree with them, I at least understand where they're coming from instead of just assuming that we're living in this country that's full of bigots, full of racist people, full of hateful people. You know, that's not a good worldview to have. It's not conducive to living a happy life, and it's also not rooted in reality. So that's where most of the changes came from. And that tweet that you just referenced is pretty cringeworthy.
Although I would like to say, if any trans people have slept with Joe Rogan, you can reach out to us too. We would also be interested in talking to you. You know, it's interesting. You sort of embody that quote, who was it, Irving Kristol, that quote about a liberal being mugged by reality. That literally happened to you.
That's true. I mean, I wasn't literally mugged, but it was, look, and people get on my case about this, like, oh, well, you weren't willing to see the truth until you experienced something. And that's true.
That's how shit works.
That is unfortunately how stuff works. Yes, definitely.
That's the exact same thing happened to me. And I think it happens to most people. I think a lot of people have found this podcast because they've gone through some destabilizing experience, realizing that the things they always thought were true aren't true. So give me an example. What are some of the platitudes that you always believe that you have come to believe are now wrong?
It's not so much the platitudes, it's the double standards that really continue to wake me up. I think the believe all women phrase during the Me Too era was an interesting, it was just an interesting era to revisit, because in the modern times, right, if you have someone like me, for instance, who expresses a terrible experience and I just want to talk about it, like I wasn't even looking to make a point. It was just, I've gone through this. It's awful. I don't know. I just felt like being vulnerable with my audience, which apparently was a really, really bad decision. And to be fair, look, most people in our audience didn't say terrible things. Okay. So, but that woke me up. And then you look at what we're seeing in modern times, for instance, the allegations of Hamas carrying out rapes and the denials around that are shocking. Look, Norm Finkelstein he goes much further than I've ever gone in regard to critiquing trans activists or the trans community. Someone like Breonna Joy Gray totally trashed me over my mild tweet about how I'd like to be referred to, but she can't get enough of Norm Finkelstein and would never criticize him for his stance on the trans community. There's just like so many double standards. And I realize that a lot of this is theater. A lot of this is similar to what you'd experience in high school, like the cliquishness and the scolding and the in-group, out-group stuff. And so I've decided that I don't want to be wedded to any of that. And if you kind of shed yourself of ideology and instead try to find the truth in any given story you're covering, you're going to be led in a much better direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a journalist, this does put you in an uncomfortable position. I experienced a similar thing at The Stranger. I was, since really the day I started there, pretty unpopular, I think, because of this position. And then I made it worse for myself by doing things like questioning some Me Too stories, which was very unpopular to do in 2016, 2017, 2018. So what was it like for you? What is it like for you to be at work now?
It's not too bad. Most people from work actually get to work from home. So it's not like I'm confronted by coworkers who are furious with me. When I put out that tweet, that was probably the most uncomfortable I've ever been at work, because there was...
Because you said you'd rather be called a woman than a pregnant person.
Correct.
Or whatever, a birthing person.
Birthing person or person with a uterus or person who menstruates. Like, I don't...
Right.
Listen, I get that there are activist groups who want to normalize talking about getting your period or whatever. I would prefer not to talk about it.
Right.
So, you know, those bodily functions being used to identify women really bother me. And
we should just refer to everybody as a person who shits. Although that might not be inclusive of people who don't shit.
Only for men though. Only for men.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's just what ended up happening was we had at the time one transgender colleague, her name is Benny. When she started working for us, she hadn't transitioned yet and hadn't even told anyone that she identified as transgender. And so I met Benny as male, and we didn't ever really work too closely together. I think we might have hosted one panel discussion on our network. But she really felt the need to represent the trans community and speak out against me. And so she starts putting out tweets, starts making videos about me, starts having these conversations, wants to have a debate with me and Cenk on air. Cenk says
while still working there? While you're all working there.
Oh yes. My God. Yeah. And Cenk was willing to talk to Benny privately. And
this is Cenk Unger. This is your co-host.
Yeah, Cenk Unger. Yeah, he's
Unger.
The
okay.
founder, CEO, and also the co-host of the main TYT show. And that conversation apparently was not good enough for Benny. And so she ends up leaving the company very publicly. And so do the moderators for our YouTube chat. They put out a Google Doc. I've never read it. I thought it was ridiculous. Just saying that I'm a terrible transphobe and it's unacceptable. At that time, by the way, Cenk also said some stuff that apparently really got under people's skin because he thinks that, you know, the trans athlete situation is a lot more difficult to find solutions for. And we need to find a way to move forward that's as fair as possible to all parties involved, including, you know, girls and women that don't have the same, you know, muscle mass and all of that stuff. Anyway, so it was just TYT went from being this leftist utopia for people to suddenly having these two hosts that are willing to question certain things that we had previously been unwilling to question. And so we get accused now of being right-wingers. We get accused of all sorts of taking money, of being grifters, even though my financial situation hasn't changed, even though I've never left to work somewhere else. They keep claiming that I'm waiting for a Daily Wire contract, which is hilarious because I don't think I'd be very happy at the Daily Wire. I don't think they take kindly to some of our coverage of what's happening in Gaza, for instance. And so I'm just in this weird place because I don't really belong in any specific ideology at the moment. And I think that would be the case for most people if they, again, untether themselves from a partisan group and just focused on what the truth of any given situation actually is.
So you said that this has made your work a little bit harder and your life a little bit better, but I'm curious, I mean, this shift you've gone through has obviously caused some conflict for you at work and on and online. You get dragged on the internet, including by former fans and colleagues. There's a Twitter account called Post Left Watch that is particularly dedicated to painting you as a fascist. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
Well, Post Left Watch is an interesting case because whoever the person is running that Twitter account or X account, he or she will literally highlight points that I want to amplify, right? Like, so sometimes they'll take me out of context and so I'll have to clarify, but oftentimes what I would do is I would quote tweet the video or the clip and I would say something along the lines of, yes, I did say this and I just want to double down because it's true. Or I would say, oh, it's missing this context. And then most people in the replies and the likes sided with me and then probably left some negative comments for the person running that account. And so they just decided to block me so they can continue doing what they're doing without me having the ability to respond to it, which I think is a cowardly and pathetic move.
Yeah.
But it's this.
It's the Michael Hobbs move.
Yeah, totally. And I just, again, find it so cowardly. If you're going to call me out, give me the opportunity to respond and either defend myself or engage in a debate with me if you want to. That's totally fine. But one of the more recent examples was I gave Florida Governor Ron DeSantis praise because he immediately did something about the squatter issue that is kind of taking place all across the country. It's been a real problem in New York. And while I don't know how widespread it was in Florida, the legislature passed a bipartisan law that Ron DeSantis signed. And I was impressed with how quickly they moved on the issue. Apparently, you're not supposed to give anyone on the right praise, even if they do something good. But I do not subscribe to that anymore at all. So if they do something good, I'm going to give them praise for it. And that's what I did with Ron DeSantis. And then a week later, he did something I totally disagreed with and I criticized him for it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's strange to me that this is somehow controversial. I mean, I guess it is, because if you want to be spoon-fed things that you already believe, there's Fox News and there's MSNBC, and they seem to be doing okay, although not as well as they used to. But to me, it just seems boring to follow a commentator who is so predictable that you always know what they're going to believe based on the affiliation of the person they're talking about.
Yeah. And by the way, like, what a boring society to live in. That was the other thing. I remember you...
Team red or team blue, and that's it.
Exactly. And I remember you had a podcast episode with Kat Rosenfield, and mm-hmm. she talked about her transformation. And she said one line that resonated so much with me. She said, "I was so bored."
Yeah.
And I went through two straight years of feeling so bored, like bored with my job, bored with life. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And it was because I had unwittingly, without even realizing it, turned my brain off and just decided to go along with the default positions and talking points of my political side. And when you do that, when you stop thinking for yourself, life tends to get real boring and predictable.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so from the position that you're in now, looking back over your career, are there stories you've done that you now regret?
Oh, deeply, deeply, deeply regret. I would say that the area where I felt the most uncomfortable was actually listening to this podcast that I love so much.
Huh.
Because by listening to your podcast, I realized that some of the stories that we covered were covered inaccurately. And mm-hmm. oh my God, like I don't know if you ever get this feeling in the pit of your stomach related to like past reporting that you've done, but when you realize that maybe you got something wrong, it's just like this sick feeling. And it's not so much about my personal embarrassment in getting it wrong. It's the guilt of misleading my audience. Obviously, it wasn't intentional, but it was still misinforming my audience. And I just take what I do seriously. I feel like there's a responsibility involved, and I don't want to do harm through the work I do. I actually want to produce something positive in the world. I'm not this delusional person who thinks I'm going to change the world or anything like that, but I do believe that there's a lot of responsibility involved in the work that we do. And if we're misinforming people, it's just going to lead them in directions or in favor of policies that might actually be super destructive for their communities and for their lives. So Rebecca Jones is a good example. I totally fell for her grift. And after I realized how...
And let me interrupt you real quick. So Rebecca Jones is the so-called whistleblower out of Florida who convinced most of the mainstream media that she had found that Ron DeSantis' administration was covering up COVID deaths.
Exactly. That was the dominant narrative in the media. You did a good job in really diving deep into that story to find out what the reality was. And it turned out
the reality is that she's a fucking nut.
She is a total grifter. And
a fraud.
I felt so sick to my stomach. In fact, I immediately texted a good friend of mine who turned me on to your podcast. His name's Tom. And it's funny because I started listening to your podcast before my transformation happened. Mm-hmm. And so every time I came across a podcast episode where I realized, oh my God, I got this story totally wrong, I would like text him and tell him how awful I feel. I'm like, what do I do? Do I just do like a ton of correction? It's like, you, and he's like, okay, you need to be strategic about this. Little by little, pick the ones that you're most upset about getting wrong and start correcting them. And that's what I started to do. You know, some portion of the audience just didn't want to accept it, which was upsetting, but it is what it is. I was happy that it was just a tiny, tiny fraction of the audience. And so they would reject the corrections. Kyle Rittenhouse was another example. Mm-hmm. But the majority of people decided to stick around and found my ability to correct the record inspiring, and they were happy about it. And I think that it actually ends up building trust with your audience instead totally. Of doing the opposite.
There is this, I realized this a couple years ago, when you admit that you are wrong about something, it can be so incredibly difficult for any human, not just a journalist, but for anybody, even if you're in a fight with your spouse or whatever, to admit that you're wrong about something. But when you do it, I mean, it's almost a little bit manipulative, because when you actually do it, it endears you to people. If you do it honestly, and I'm not talking about, you know, putting out a statement about how you're going to do clap, better clap. I mean, when you honestly admit that you have done something wrong or you've gotten something wrong, it makes people trust you more. And I saw your correction to the Rebecca Jones story. I thought it was fantastic and very brave. I was really impressed by that. It made me, the fact that you admit that you were wrong about that made me trust you more. So I think more journalists should be willing to do that when we actually get something wrong. And the other thing about the Rebecca Jones story that I find so interesting is that I completely understand why you got this story wrong, because almost all leftists and liberal and mainstream media did get it wrong. And I didn't go down to Florida and investigate her on my own. The only reason I knew that this story was bullshit was because I spent a few years broadening my media diet. And it was all over conservative media that this story was bullshit. Charles Cook from the National Review was the first person to write a real investigation into her claims. His piece was incredibly thorough. And the only reason I saw it was because I follow conservatives on Twitter, which is something I only started doing, you know, in like 2017, 2018. So it's very easy to not just ignore information that is inconvenient to you, but to not even be exposed to it.
That's exactly right. And I actually ended up doing the same. And so let me ask you a question, because this is where things have gotten a little challenging when I try to correct the record or when I try to cover a story from a direction that the left already has rejected. So since I have that more diverse media diet, and since I have access as a result to a more, like a fuller picture of what the story is, oftentimes when I'm trying to relay that information to my audience, that information is coming from conservative sources that in their minds, they've already discredited. And so if I bring up that conservative source, they're going to be like, "That there's no credibility. How could you? I can't believe that you would quote the National Review. How dare you?" You know, that's the take. And so how do you cut through that thinking to get people to believe the truth?
You know, I don't think that's as much of an issue with my audience, because we have cultivated an audience inadvertently. We didn't, like, all of this is very organic, but we have cultivated an audience that I think is much less doctrinaire when it comes to things like that. Mm-hmm. We know when I was at The Stranger, that would absolutely be a problem, but I just keep doing it, you know, and I don't really know what else to do except keep doing it and hope that some portion of the audience is going to be open-minded enough to say, okay, wait, just because I might not like the source on this doesn't mean the story itself is wrong. Mm-hmm. And for us, so many people have found this show because they have had some issue. Usually it's gender, usually it's the trans issue, that just puts them at odds with their community or with the way they used to believe. And I think that it can be very destabilizing, but it can also be a really positive, enlightening moment when you're like, holy shit, the things I always thought were true some of them weren't true.
Right.
And, you know, that can be a very scary thing. It just opens up the world in a way that can be really exciting.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. The destabilizing element of it is very much true. And that's definitely the worst part of it. But I also agree that it opens up a new exciting world. Going back to what I was feeling about boredom, I don't have that boredom anymore. And suddenly I've opened up my mind to hearing other voices who, you know, previously I thought all these terrible things about, but then you start reading their content or watching the videos they put together and you realize, oh my God, I had a totally inaccurate idea of who this person is.
Yeah.
And so I like that because again, it goes back to what's been making me happier in my personal life, kind of seeing the world for what it is and not having this like doomer mentality about everyone who disagrees with me politically. But the one thing I'll say, this is the final thing I'll say, because I don't think I've ever said this anywhere else. And it's what I feel internally and what I'm kind of dealing with behind the scenes. I've only done one thing in life and it was TYT. Like really, I've done one thing. I don't have kids. I've chosen not to. And I feel that I have a lot of guilt and I feel like the one thing I've done in life, I've done it wrong. So I'm just trying to be better.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
Well, you're doing, I think, a fantastic job. And I really appreciate you putting yourself out there. And not even just in the fact that the work that you're doing on your show, but you've become sort of you've sort of made your debut in the like pervert for nuance community. We're very happy to have you here. But why did you decide to like come out, as it were, to borrow a term?
I decided to come out because I don't want to keep doing the wrong thing. Once I realized I did do the wrong thing, I wanted to change course. And this is beyond me. I've wanted to work in journalism since I was in middle school. That's my first love. That's my passion. And I unfortunately got derailed by political ideology, and I just want to go back to my roots, okay? And my roots are to value genuine journalism. And that's why I'm so offended by the way people like you and Jesse are treated. I actually didn't know that Jesse was canceled until I started listening to this podcast. So back in 2018, when he published his Atlantic piece, I had never read it. And I didn't know about the, you know, debacle that he was going through because of it. And so after listening to your podcast for some number of months, I'm like, oh, let me go back and read this piece. I mean, there might be something in there that's inflammatory. And I was actually shocked at how fair it was, how empathetic it was to the trans community, and the fact that they tried to cancel him and the fact that he's a constant target by Majority Report really bothers me, because it's so anti-journalism to go after someone like Jesse and someone like you.
I am 100% sure that nobody affiliated with Majority Report has ever read his work at all. They don't know what they're talking about. They really don't. I would love to see Sam Cedar go through some sort of transformation the way that you have. And usually that comes because you take some position that gets you attacked by your own side. I cannot see him. I cannot see him going through that. He is so fucking sure that he is correct, even when he's talking about the things that he is completely uninformed over.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think your analysis of that is totally correct.
You know, I've been on this, I think, very similar sort of ideological journeys. I'm a little bit further along on it, to the point where I'm sort of becoming cynical about like my new tribe. So I want to offer you some unsolicited advice, which is that level of skepticism that you have now, apply it as well to your new ideology or to the people around you. I don't really know what to call this, but your new circles, I guess. It's just best practice as a journalist and a critic, obviously, but just speaking from experience. So in the past, like, I've defended people who I thought were being unfairly smeared, because once that happens to you, at least my response to that is to become sort of hyper aware of it. And become much more likely to go out on a limb and defend people who I think don't deserve it. And then later, some of those people turned out to be really the exact cartoon villains that their critics painted them as all mm-hmm. along, which of course makes me look like a dumbass, which, I mean, that's not that important. I'm okay looking like a dumbass, but internet poisoning is so real. And I think people who have been wrongly smeared are particularly susceptible to this. And then there's this destabilizing effect, right? So when you start to question your own beliefs about things like gender ideology or race or vaccine mandates or whatever it is, you know, it can be so destabilizing that a few years later, you're Naomi Wolf howling at the moon or, you know, James Lindsay howling at groomers. And this is something that I've seen more and more of among people who a couple years ago I thought were really thoughtful. So watch out for that.
Yeah, for sure. No, I am definitely aware of that. And I guess my standard operating procedure now is anytime there's some contentious story, controversial issue, I just don't take anyone at face value, regardless of their political ideology. I do my best to fact check all the claims. And when you operate that way and when you're not wedded to any particular side, I just think that it produces the clearest and most accurate analysis of the situation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about this. Okay, before we move on, I want to ask you one question. This came from Twitter. I asked my Twitter followers if they had any questions for you, and someone said, have you developed a different understanding on someone like Dave Rubin post your own encounter with the cult left? This one probably needs some context. So will you explain who Dave Rubin is for the boomers in the audience first?
Sure. So Dave Rubin was a former colleague of mine. I met him at TYT, where he worked for a few years. He had his own show with the company, and he and I actually ended up becoming close friends. I would go to his home over the weekends and we would have dinner together. I was close with his now husband. They weren't married at the time. And he was very clearly liberal, but had some issues at TYT because, you know, he was under this assumption that TYT was making like so much money and that, you know, at the time we could afford to pay him, six figures to host a 30-minute-a-week show, which we did not have the funds for.
Wait, 30 minutes once a week?
Correct. Yeah. It was called the Rubin Report. And, you know, he was my friend, so I never wanted to like crush his dreams of making more money. But I did tell him, like, it's not what you think it is. Like, Cenk Uygur isn't hoarding a bunch of money. Like, he's driving a Grand Am from the 80s, like, you know, mm-hmm. And eventually he decides, no, I want to leave and I want to make more money, which is totally fine. But as soon as he left, something significant changed. Like, he just started trashing the company. He started claiming that we were editing, you know, our interviews, which wasn't true at all. In fact, the only thing that we had edited was a panel discussion that he was on. And the debate was about Israel. And he's, you know, the one thing that he's always been consistent on is his support for Israel. And he said something that was not going to be taken well by the audience. So he asked us to edit it out. And I think that it was edited out, but he just like started bad mouthing us and he was still my friend. So I reached out to him and asked, what's going on here? And he said something along the lines of, I'm not attacking you by name. I'm attacking the company. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm the face of the company. That's a problem.
Right.
And then he just started presenting himself as right wing, which was also shocking because as someone I knew closely, I just knew he wasn't right wing. And I totally understand that people do go through political changes. I'm experiencing that myself right now, but it was such a wild swing and there was really no explanation for it. And so for 2 years straight, I did not publicly address it because it was painful. It was like hurtful to lose a friend in the way that I lost Dave. But eventually he kept poking, and I just lost it. And I accused him of doing this all for money. Now, I don't know for sure, and people might disagree with my interpretation of events, and that's totally fine. I just feel like it's harder to buy that his changes were organic, mostly because it was like such a wild swing out of nowhere with no real explanation.
Right. And so having gone through this process yourself, a different ideological shift, but still having this experience, do you have more sympathy for Dave now, or do you feel like still feel like he did this? He's a grifter, basically.
My mind is more open to the idea that it's a genuine political shift. I would need to see, from what I've seen of Dave Rubin, there's less explanation for why he believes what he believes. That's why it's been so hard for me to buy it. Right. You get what I'm saying? Right. Like,
totally.
Yeah, that's all.
I mean, when Dave first came out as this, like, you know, there was that whole New York Times article by Barry Weiss about the IDW, and Dave was featured in that. And then he started campaigning for Trump, essentially. And I wrote a piece for The Stranger at the time, something about how, you know, Dave Rubin is correct when he sees these flaws in the left. But my argument was that, you know, the solution here isn't to become a Republican or to start campaigning for Donald Trump. It's to try to reform the left so that it is better. And he was just, he had such a, like, even his response to that piece was just extremely nasty. He accused me of having a crush on him, which is just, but it was this moment when a lot of people were sort of coming up on the scene. A lot of political alliances were shifting, and Dave, he just, I don't know. It just, to me, it never felt genuine. And I don't know him personally, so I might be wrong about that. But he has certainly stuck with it for now. But he just seems like the type of person who, as the wind shifts, he will shift with them.
Yeah, I have the same sense. The one thing that I will confess to feeling a little bit of sympathy toward Dave on is, you know, when he first left, he made the claim that the left tries to silence people by smearing them as one of the isms, mm-hmm. you know, racist, right. One of those things, like whatever it is. And it's true that people are terrified of being labeled one of those words. So they do avoid saying things that might be a little more provocative, or they avoid questioning certain narratives that might have some issues. I didn't believe that until a few years ago, and now I see it now, because
it's totally true.
It is true. And I do get a lot of private messages from people on the left who say things like, oh my God, thank you for speaking out, I really appreciate it, but they don't feel comfortable speaking out. And honestly, part of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it so openly and loudly is because I want others to feel okay doing what I'm doing. I want them to know that it's not going to be the end of the world if you start questioning things, or if you say you disagree with certain narratives on the left. It's okay. It doesn't make you a bad person.
Yeah. So for me, going through this over the past couple of years, the hardest part has 100% without a doubt been all of the friendships that I've lost, which is like 90% of my friendships. And I think for me, it's been worse because I really did, for most of my adult life, my friendships were, I was in circles of radical queers, people who you know, are anti-capitalists, people who are camped out outside the lawn of, if not Princeton, Whole Foods, if that's what they can get to, protesting right now. That was always my circle. And this is, I think, a particularly intolerant group of people. I mean, so have you experienced that as well, your personal relationship severing? Besides Dave?
So the good news is I've always had a group of friends that are not tied to the work I do. The friends that I've had since I was a teenager, I'm very, very lucky. It's very tight-knit, and they've always been my foundation. And I will admit that since I have that in my life, it has made this process a little easier. If you don't have that, if you're, you know, if everyone in your friend circle is tied to the work you do, that makes this process a lot more difficult. But I will say, everyone who I considered a friend that I've worked with has publicly condemned me, every single Jesus. One. And that has been very hard to stomach. And the fact of the matter is, they're not my friends. Yeah. They're just not. Yeah. They're my colleagues, and it is what it is. And I have them at an arm's distance or arm's length because I can't be vulnerable with them. I can't trust them. And I would never in a million years trash them the way that they've trashed me publicly.
Yeah. Do you have any tips on how to deal with a situation like that? Our listener is like 90% canceled people.
My tip would be to not roll around in the mud with these people and instead seek comfort in your personal relationships outside of this group, right? So people you trust, spend time with your pets. I know it sounds kind of hippy dippy, but it's totally true. Go outside and touch grass, go for a hike. It really makes all the difference. Like being out in nature is what totally saved me because even though I have a group of friends that I love, sometimes I just need to be on my own and just kind of think things through and process it and decompress. And what better place than nature to do that? So go out there and seriously touch the grass.
Yeah, I have found the exact same thing, that being outside, touching moss in my case, because I'm in the Pacific Northwest, but this is really the best way to get offline. Even, I mean, it doesn't even have to be like in nature, but just like put the fucking phone down.
Totally. It makes all the difference. It really does.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking about this. Let's do housekeeping and then we will get to your segment.
Let's do it.
But first, an ad for our free listeners.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too?
That's right. That's the sound of selling everywhere, online, in-store, on social media, and beyond.
Shopify POS, no, not that POS, is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory to building relationships with customers and managing orders, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person, backed by everything you need to sell online.
With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock.
Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok, if it's still legal by the time you hear this, to Instagram and beyond.
Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone. Transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution.
Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify.
We should try this with our horrible merch store.
Oh my God, this is good. This synergy opportunity.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/barpod, all lowercase.
Go to shopify.com/barpod to take your retail business to the next level today. Please help us with our merch. Oh my God.
That's shopify.com/barpod. We are a podcast. This is Blocked and Reported. So you can reach out to us at blockedandreportedpodcast@gmail.com. We are also on Reddit. Our Reddit is, you know what, just search for it. I can't look it up anymore. This is my last week doing this on my own. Jesse's going to be back to do it next week. You'll get it all correctly. I did see people on the Reddit complaining about the merch store. I have told you guys, do not buy the merch. The reason the merch is terrible is not because I'm lazy, contrary to what some of you Redditors were saying. It's because the woman who runs the merch store disappeared. If you had, contrary to my direct instructions, purchased some merch and you haven't received it, please reach out to us. Yes. And then if you're thinking about buying merch, buy it from somewhere else. Buy it from the Young Turks if you have to. Do not buy our merch. More importantly, if you would like to support the show, go to blockedandreported.org, where for just $5 a month, you can become a primo. You get extra content every month, at least 3 extra episodes, although we've been doing more. I think we did 4 last month. You also get your episodes early and ad-free, and this is the best way to support the show. I think that's it. I'm probably forgetting something important, but Jesse will be back soon. He can correct next week. All right. You've got the wheel.
All right. Well, our story today takes place in Los Angeles, California. But if you're living in some other big city, the issue that we're about to dive into is likely being replicated in your part of the country. Katie, are you familiar with something called the Traffic Enforcement Alternatives Advisory Task Force?
I am not. It sounds like a lot of words to probably explain a fairly simple concept. That seems to be a common theme among advisory boards, as many words as possible.
Totally. It's a very clunky name. But don't worry, neither do the vast majority of people living in LA, which is a problem that we're going to get into in just a little bit. But let's actually start at the very beginning. During the hot, riotous month of June 2020, as our racial reckoning was underway, some of the most progressive city council members introduced this motion to study the impact of replacing police with unarmed civilians for the purposes of traffic enforcement. Mm-hmm. And like the thinking behind this is that, you know, getting pulled over by a cop was an automatic death sentence for Black men. So with very little debate, the city council's motion was approved and the clunkily named Traffic Enforcement Alternatives Advisory Task Force was established. Now, the Los Angeles Department of Transportation, or LA DOT, is overseeing the new task force, which is super relevant because if the literal activists hired for this task force get their way, unarmed LA DOT employees would be carrying out traffic enforcement instead of the police. Like, they would be the ones pulling people over on the road. And Katie, look, before we go any further, let me check your temperature on this. How do you feel about the possibility of abolishing police from doing traffic stops?
Well, I'm concerned with the employees who are going to be tasked with enforcing traffic laws. I mean, if we lived in a different country, like I am sure that in like England, a place without many guns and where even the cops are unarmed, cops can regularly enforce traffic laws without the risk of being murdered, and people can regularly speed without the risk of being shot by cops or whatever, not just speeding, but driving recklessly or whatever. Mm-hmm. We don't live in that society. We live in a heavily armed society. I personally know someone, a kid I went to high school with, was killed, horrible story, was killed in his first months on the job after pulling someone over. He was shot by someone who didn't want to be pulled over. So my first instinct, not knowing much about it, is that this is a fucking horrible idea. This is destined to fail in this country at this time.
Yeah, I mean, the foundation of this idea really relies on this notion that everyone is actually an angel. Like there, right. No one ever engages in any violence or any risky behavior. And the only problem in any of these equations is the police. And all we need to do is do away with the cops and everything will be fine. And well, let's get into it. We'll see what the reality is. So, you know, what's really interesting about how this effort came to be is that no one considered the safety risks involved for the unarmed civilians that would be replacing the cops.
Yeah.
So like a few years ago, the West Side Current, it's like a local paper, rattled off all the things that this new motion included, but they made sure to note one thing, that the motion does not talk about the safety of the civilian enforcement. But that's okay because, you know, traffic stops are never dangerous or unpredictable or anything.
Oh, right. Yeah. Especially when people are drunk. That's the best time to pull people over.
Right. Exactly. So I mentioned that the task force consists of literal activists, and that's because the two current co-chairs, a guy named Chauncey Smith and then another person named Asi Yahola Sankara, specialize in certain fields that would lead one to believe that maybe they're not the neutral arbiters one would want to study something that could have a huge impact on public safety. So, Katie, can you read what the bio for Chauncey Smith says on the Catalyst California website?
Okay. Chauncey serves as the Associate Director of Reimagine Justice and Safety at Catalyst California. He works in partnership with community-based organizations and government stakeholders to advance equity-driven public policies that improve California's criminal legal system and make communities safer, especially for low-income people of color. Prior to joining Catalyst California, Chauncey was the legislative and racial justice advocate for the ACLU of California Center for Advocacy and Policy.
Yeah, like sounds like he might have some, you know, biases that could be detrimental to the studies that this task force produces, no?
Right. I mean, it sounds like Chauncey has an agenda and it might not matter what the studies actually fund.
Okay, right. So now let's take a look at the other co-chair. Let's be fair, because maybe this is a person coming from the other side of this issue, right? So Asi Yahola Sankara is his name. I found his bio on the UCLA Lewis Center for Regional Policy Studies website. Katie, can you read this for us?
Asi Yahola Sankara is an Equal Justice Works Fellow at the ACLU of Southern California. His work focuses on transportation-related police practices that harm Black, Brown, and low-income people. Before the ACLU, Asi Yahola served as the campaign manager at the Alliance for Community Transit, where he led work to reimagine public safety on transit by steering funds away from policing and towards infrastructure improvements. He graduated from Pomona, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they should have had like one dude who has like a thin blue line T-shirt and one guy with a BLM T-shirt. That would have made this a little bit more more bipartisan.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking how this task force is just wall to wall activists who already have their mind made up about the issue. So the whole point of a task force is to study what the outcomes of a proposed policy would be. And it's super important because we're literally talking about the second largest city in the country. We, unfortunately, you know, crime statistics just came in. We are having an issue with crime in Los Angeles. Luckily, homicides went down all across the country with one exception, LA. And so we're short hundreds of police officers because a lot of them retired early in 2020. It's just been really difficult to recruit. Like, things are going in a bad direction as it is, and we need real neutral arbiters to look into these issues and find the best policies to move forward with.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this sort of gets to what we were talking about earlier. I think the this is maybe a sweeping generalization, but the group that going through this ideological transformation over the past couple of years, this awakening, the group that I have, or the maybe position that I have become the most skeptical of as a journalist, is activist of any fucking type. Do not trust the activist.
Yeah, I cannot agree more. I really can't, because what I've kind of woken up to is a lot of news companies conducting interviews with activists as if they're experts on an issue, when in reality, you're literally, it's like interviewing an executive from a tobacco company to talk about how wonderful it is to smoke.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
So I'm also skeptical. It's not that I don't ever listen to anything they have to say. Obviously, I take their points and consider it and look into it, but I also want to look into people who are, you know, less biased to figure out what the reality is. And look, to be fair to the activists who were hired for this task force, they are more likely to push the city council to form the advisory task force in the first place. More objective members of the community are not as plugged into this issue since, you know, normies are not invested in this the way the activists are. They're less likely to apply to even be part of the task force. I just don't think a biased task force should be producing studies that impact policy decisions. And, you know, do you think that's fair?
It's totally fair. I mean, you should value it about as much as you would value a study produced by police on the issue. Like, these are going to be biased.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. In order to really see how this overwhelming anti-police bias plays out in the wild, we're going to listen to snippets of the April 3rd Transportation Committee meeting. But allow me to introduce all the participants involved. So the meeting was led by Chauncey Smith, who we're already familiar with, and a woman named Leslie Cooper Johnson. She's also on the task force. She's the vice president of organizational development at a nonprofit called Community Coalition. Katie, who is the founder of Community Coalition, according to their website?
Okay, it looks like it was founded by the LA mayor, Karen Bass. Okay, so she works as a VP for a nonprofit founded by the mayor, and she was chosen to be a leading voice on this anti-policing task force?
Correct. So for this meeting, you have Chauncey Smith and Leslie Cooper Johnson representing the task force. Uh-huh. All of the city council members involved are pretty much in favor of fully eliminating or minimizing the role of police, except for one rebellious woman, Tracy Park. Park is a Democrat, but she's also sane, which is which is a bit of an endangered species here in Los Angeles. She was elected to replace Mike Bonin, who was a deeply disliked city council member who decided against running for re-election after there was this effort to recall him. He was one of the city council members who introduced the motion for this task force. Now, Tracy Park is the only member of the Transportation Committee who wants to pump the brakes time to time when it comes to some of the wackier far left ideas. She was totally on brand during this meeting and happened to be the only one to ask pretty basic questions that needed to be answered.
this committee's hearing on this topic back in December, we learned that LAPD had removed about 1,400 guns during vehicle stops that resulted in arrests. I frequently hear that domestic violence calls and traffic stops are amongst the most dangerous circumstances for our police officers. Is there any way for us to ensure, or how are we, if we move forward with something like this, knowing the risks and the dangers that we are putting people into, how are we going to mitigate that?
Okay, I really want to emphasize how insanely important her question is. Not only should local lawmakers have an ounce of concern for the safety of the theoretical unarmed civilians carrying out traffic stops, but like, who's liable if,
right,
and when, honestly, right, they get hurt? Like, Park was also questioning whether anyone looked into the legality of policy changes like this, because there's a good chance that civilian traffic enforcement replacing sworn officers violates state law. Now, keep in mind that it's 2024 and the motion to create this task force passed 4 years ago. I mean, I just feel like we should already have answers to these questions, right, Katie?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Do we not?
We don't. Okay, so maybe 4 years is not enough. And to be clear, Leslie Johnson was not really amused with Tracy Park's line of questioning. So let's go to our next clip from the meeting. You're going to hear from Leslie Johnson, Tracy Park, and also a representative from the Los Angeles Police Department.
I just had a question in terms of what you were saying around the danger of the traffic stops. Is there data that you're pulling from that documents the danger of traffic stops for police officers?
So we have LAPD here. I'm more than happy to hear from you again directly about these circumstances and the number of guns that are recovered from these kinds of stops.
So I don't have the data so far that matches up with the number of traffic stops for this year, but we have had one police officer that was injured 2 weeks ago as a result of a traffic stop because the motorist tried to run him over as he was approaching the vehicle. Last year, LAPD made 226,216 traffic stops and shot nobody.
Katie, we're back to how unsafe traffic stops can be for cops. Activists think that it's a bunch of BS, but what do you think?
I mean, it would be really good to have data on this. So we have data from him that he says LAPD made over 200,000 traffic stops and nobody was shot. That's frankly pretty impressive. My hunch is that it is dangerous, and maybe this is something that I've just bought because I know this is something that police say all the time, that the most dangerous moment for a cop is when you've pulled somebody over.
You know, what I appreciated about what the LAPD rep said was that, you know, it kind of cuts through the narrative that police are just going around and like executing people during right. traffic stops, because right. that is what inspired this task force to begin with. Mm-hmm. And it is important to actually avoid falling into the trap of anecdotes, like anecdotal evidence yeah. of police behaving poorly, and instead take a look at the broader picture to see if, you know, police shootings during traffic stops are in fact like a widespread issue.
Yeah.
So look, and traffic stops absolutely can be dangerous and unpredictable. Though the raw numbers of cops getting killed is low, the FBI does keep track of the number of police killed each year and how they died. So out of the 129 officers who were killed in the line of duty in 2021, 9 of them died as a result of enforcement activities like surveillance and traffic violation stops. Another 8 were killed in vehicular or foot pursuits. Mm-hmm. Then there's the National Law Enforcement Memorial Fund's 2023 annual report. They found that out of the 136 law enforcement deaths, 5 were shot and killed while making or attempting to make traffic stops. Again, this is in 2023. One other officer was intentionally struck by a car and killed as he was deploying a tire deflation device during a vehicle pursuit. So this year obviously isn't over yet, but we're not off to a great start. So there are some recent high-profile cases we could look at. Deputy Tobin Bolter was shot and killed during a traffic stop in Boise, Idaho recently. A few weeks ago, 2 cops, sheriff's lieutenant, Michael Husak and Syracuse police officer Michael Jensen were fatally shot after searching for a driver who fled a traffic stop in upstate New York. Then there's this super high-profile case involving Officer Jonathan Diller. He was fatally shot in New York last month after he approached a car that was illegally parked. That was a huge, it was crazy. Like, that was a huge story, and it became even more high profile because Trump attended Diller's funeral while local Democrats like Kathy Hochul were not welcome.
Oh, God.
And then there's two cops in Eastern Tennessee who were shot in February of this year. Deputy Greg McCowan died. Another deputy, Shelby Eggers, luckily survived. So obviously there is a degree of danger involved for those conducting traffic stops. I don't know, like, am I being unimaginative for not wanting to reimagine who conducts these traffic enforcement stops?
Yeah, Anna, you just need to open your mind to the possibilities here. Like, for instance, they could take the unarmed civilians who are going to be tasked with enforcing traffic laws and, I don't know, give them a badge and a gun, maybe. Maybe even a car with a siren on top. I can't see. Obviously, having unarmed civilians do these stops is not going to work. There are more guns in this country than there are people. Maybe this is like down the line if the gun control advocates get their way and everybody turns in their guns and gets like 100 sunflowers or whatever. Maybe that this would be a feasible solution. I mean, it is important, though, like you said, to contextualize this. There are, I don't know how many millions of traffic stops every year. If, if a few dozen cops get killed, that is a relatively low number. And what I fear is that police, when they're training, when they're doing these police trainings, get a skewed message that makes them think it's more common than it is. And so they're more likely to pull guns on people who might not be armed. And it's the same thing on both sides, right? It's the media taking isolated incidents, blowing them up so that they seem more common than they are, and then failing to contextualize. And this is something I've been really critical of in terms of reporting on the deaths of unarmed Black people. How often when you're listening to NPR or watching MSNBC or whatever, do they say, this person was killed by cops, by the police, and he is one of, 10 unarmed Black men killed by the police every year? By not contextualizing this, by not putting numbers to these awful incidents, the public gets a very skewed perspective on how dangerous the world is.
I totally agree with you. And you're right. I mean, when you look at the broader picture, even with these police officers tragically getting killed, when you consider how many police officers there are, when you consider how many traffic stops occur in any given year in this country, the number is low, right? It is rare. That's true. And I would venture to say that when it comes to police, I'm not even going to venture to say, I mean, we're going to dive into the data in just a bit, but we've been so hyper-focused on the anecdotes of police-involved shootings that it kind of blurred the bigger picture of how officer-involved shootings have actually consistently gone down decade after decade. So we'll get to that in a moment. But for now, I want to get back to that transportation committee meeting, because notice how the LAPD rep not only highlighted the dangers involved in traffic stops, but also how the LAPD didn't shoot a single person during the hundreds of thousands of traffic stops they carried out last year. And I think police shootings are worth unpacking, because despite the dominant narrative about police brutality being worse than ever before, the truth is that the country was headed in the right direction before we decided to like reimagine policing. So like perfect example is The Guardian publishing a piece titled "It Never Stops. Killings by US police reach record high in 2022. And the article relied on data from an organization called Mapping Police Violence, which does track deadly law enforcement encounters, but there's one little problem. Record high is misleading when the organization has been keeping records since
2013.
So they had...
History started very recently.
Exactly. Like, so again, it kind of hides the reality of how much police involved shootings have gone down over many decades.
Right.
And, you know, again, like, it's just less than a decade worth of data when The Guardian published that headline. And unfortunately, long-term national data on police shootings doesn't exist. And you'd have to actually look at individual cities over many decades to notice any trends. And that's actually exactly what Peter Moskos did. He's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And his analysis found that there has been a 69% drop in fatal police shootings across 18 major cities since the 1970s.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Katie, can you read this excerpt from Reason that summarizes some of Moskos's findings?
From 1970 to 1974, police shot and killed an average of 62 people per year in a population of 7.5 million people. From 2015 to 2021, police shot and killed an average of 9 people a year in a population that has grown to over 8.7 million people. Skeptics can look to Los Angeles, where the annual average declined from 30 people killed to 15 as the population expanded from by about 1 million residents. Philadelphia, which saw a decrease of 18 people killed annually to 4. Detroit, where the number went from 26 to also 4. That's significant.
It is significant, and that has not been widely reported at all.
No, it really hasn't. I mean, and there's been polling on this. If you go around to random people and you ask them how many unarmed Black people are shot by the police every year, people typically say 1,000. It's like orders of magnitude higher than it is. I mean, police do shoot on average, I think, of about like across the United States, like a country with, you know, 330 million plus people, an average of about 1,000 people a year. But that is that the vast majority of them are armed. And not that, you know, it's legal to have a gun here. Not that being armed should be a death sentence. But the vast majority of them are things like suicide by cop, where they actually actively shoot at police.
Totally. And this is an area where I also share quite a bit of guilt because, you know, you'll come across the initial reporting on an officer involved shooting and it looks really bad. It looks like it was totally unjustified. It looks outrageous. And we would cover those stories without waiting, which I think is the best thing to do with these types of stories. Like, wait, because it's not a developed story yet. There are going to be other details that come out and you should wait for those details before you report on it. And by focusing on those stories, which oftentimes ended up being reported inaccurately, what you do is you paint a picture in your audience's head about the reality of policing in America.
Totally. And this is actually dangerous because if you give Black people, particularly Black people or any minority group, the idea, the same thing happens with this narrative that there's a trans genocide, the idea that the world is more dangerous than it is, they're going to react to that. Like, it makes people unhappier. It makes them fearful. I mean, if you buy the narrative that every time that you're a Black person and every time you encounter a cop, it's going to kill you, you're more likely to run. And you know what's actually going to get you killed is running from the cops.
Yeah. Totally. It's so true. It really is.
And then the other thing is, like, I always think this when I hear the activists shout, say their names. We can't say their names because the list isn't actually that long. The other thing that the media does is consistently ignore the police shootings of unarmed white people. This is an example I brought up on this show before, but in 2020, or maybe it was 2021, within that time frame, there was a police shooting really close to where I live in Washington State, so about 10 miles from us. A guy was sitting on an overpass. Something happened, and he was shot and killed by police. The Seattle Times, the biggest paper in the region, didn't send somebody over on the fucking ferry to go investigate this case. The only thing they ran about this at the time was like a little AP blurb. Nobody heard about this because the victim was white.
That's wild. And
yeah.
I noticed that too. I mean, one of the worst police shootings I've ever seen, and this one was 1,000,000% unjustified. The video haunted me for years. It involved a guy who had like a BB gun, or it wasn't like a real gun, but he was basically in a hotel room messing with it. And yeah. You know the story? There was like
this the one in Florida?
I think it was, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember all the details, but I do remember, you know, someone from through the window sees him with what they believed was an assault weapon. They call the cops, and then the cops show up and make him crawl in the hallway of this hotel. And he's doing his best to follow orders, but they're giving him, you know, conflicting orders. And he's like, he's crying, begging the cop not to shoot him. And they shot and killed him anyway. It was awful.
But because the guy was white, this just did not become a big national story.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we covered it, but you're totally right in that it didn't get the kind of attention that, you know, some of the other stories involving black men get. And so
nobody's making a mural of him.
Yeah. And the thing that bothers me about that is not just the fact that, you know, there seems to be less interest in victims who don't have a certain skin color, but it's also pushing out this fake reality for black people in America too.
Totally.
Right.
Totally.
So I don't want people living in fear or being unnecessarily unnecessarily paranoid about every interaction that they might have with police. But, you know, getting back to Los Angeles and the traffic enforcement debate, the LAPD rep mentioned one other thing during the meeting that I want to address. So let's listen in.
I just happen to be the chief over traffic. And one of our biggest problems that we're dealing with in terms of public safety is sideshow street racing and those issues. And those vehicles tend to be, grossly modified, but I'll go ahead and say it, grossly modified outside of the realm of smog violations and outside of the realm of safe operation violations, where the resulting mechanical traffic stop is what allows us to prevent someone from being hurt or killed.
He makes a pretty devastating point there. So street takeovers have been a massive problem in LA in recent years, and people have gotten killed as a result. Like, there was this street takeover on Christmas Day in South Los Angeles where a woman in her 20s was struck by a car and killed. You know, more recently, there was this super gruesome video going around of a young woman getting hit by a car that was doing donuts in Hyde Park and then speeding away.
God, this shit makes me so fucking mad.
I know.
This is not Fast and Furious or Too Fast, Too Furious. Just act like grownups. Come on.
It really bothers me. And, you know, last year there was one other instance where this woman was in a car with her daughter and unfortunately got caught up in like a street takeover, and her car gets hit. She dies. And it's just so heartbreaking thinking about her little girl being left without a mother because of these street takeovers.
Definitely the thing that's going to shut that down is to send some unarmed civilians in to have a strict talking to with these people.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, if a car is illegally modified in a way that indicates that the motorist engages in street racing or street takeovers, so-called fix-it tickets absolutely make sense. The driver might not be engaging in a moving violation, but undoing modifications that are solely meant for drag racing, like, that should probably be dealt with. Mm-hmm. And the good news is the city council realizes that street takeovers are serious. They just don't want the cops getting involved.
What?
Yeah. So, Katie, can you read this excerpt from the LA Times?
The Los Angeles City Council has moved to target street takeovers at scores of intersections known to be sites of illicit activity. The council voted 12-1 to launch a pilot program at 20 intersections. Raised hardened center lines will be installed at the intersections to deter motorists from doing donuts and other stunts. It's extremely dangerous for police to try to stop a street takeover, in part because the cars flee at excessive speeds, endangering the public, the official said.
I mean, yeah, it's not that difficult for these guys to also find new intersections to do their donuts in.
Yeah.
And so the city council is going to play this costly whack-a-mole game and make changes to the literal infrastructure instead of simply citing illegal car modifications that are very
sorry to interrupt you there, but so giving them a ticket for these car modifications, like, do you think that would change anything?
Yeah, because what those they're literally fix-it tickets. They cost like $25, so it's not like it's not the same as a traffic violation where you get fined hundreds of dollars. And the whole point is to force people, compel people to undo the car modifications that they've done specifically to engage in like drag racing or these street takeovers.
You know, I am usually against government theft. I would be okay with impounding these cars.
Same, considering how much damage these people have done. So like based on police data, there were 482 street takeovers in Los Angeles last year. Just 1 year.
God. Yeah.
And considering how hard it is to break them up and how dangerous they can be for responding officers, what do you think about deploying unarmed civilians to do the job instead?
This is unbelievably stupid. If it's too dangerous for cops, maybe they can get some of those Boston Dynamics robots to go and like let the air out of their tires. I could see that. You could reimagine policing that way. But yeah, to put unarmed civilians in that position is just, that's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, totally. And you know, during the same city council meeting, just a side note, Ulysses Hernandez, who's the most far left member of the city council, was upset about the notion of using these fix-it tickets to get people to change the modifications. She's like, you know, people are really struggling out there. It's expensive to do these things. So I think that we should consider vouchers that taxpayers. And look, I'm just going to say this. Hernandez is also one of the city council members who totally brushed off the catalytic converter thefts that Angelenos had been victimized by and continue to be victimized by. It costs, I know from personal experience, it costs $2,000 to replace the catalytic converter. And they didn't want to address that. They didn't care about working class people living in the city who then had to pay oftentimes thousands of dollars out of pocket because oftentimes insurance doesn't cover catalytic converters. So it really infuriates me to see these ridiculous double standards. And it goes back to something that bothers me about the left as it pertains to criminal justice reform. Whenever there is a crime spike, they want to pretend like it's not happening because they don't want to have to address it. So when it came to catalytic converter thefts, there is a specific type of crime spike that they don't want to draw any attention to. And by ignoring the reality of it, they leave all of these people living in LA with a massive, costly problem with no representation from our city council. Like, it's infuriating.
What do you think explains this?
I think that there is a very real effort to just deny the reality of crime spikes. And the reason why that is because if you acknowledge that crime is spiking in certain areas, then your cutesy little pet project kind of loses some of its credibility.
And then of course, this has the communities that are actually impacted by spikes in crime.
Mm-hmm.
Are communities that are going to disproportionately be the poorest, be the blackest, be the brownest.
100%. I mean, nothing makes that clearer than what Metro workers are currently experiencing. So there is a union representing these workers. Most of them are not paid, you know, high salaries. Most of them happen to be, you know, immigrants, people who are minorities, Latinos, Black people, and they feel unsafe. And they've been begging LA to do something for their security for years now. And these are people who keep getting ignored by the leftists that have completely taken over our city council, with the exception of Tracy Park. And it is amazing to see them pat themselves on the backs as people who really look out for underrepresented communities or marginalized people, when in reality, the policies that they implement tend to victimize those communities the most.
Right. So what these Metro workers need is they need some race-based affinity groups. Maybe that would help with the people doing fentanyl on the bus.
Maybe. Okay, now let's get back to the other thing the task force would like to utilize for traffic enforcement instead of armed police. They're considering automated traffic enforcement. Okay, Katie, what do you think about relying on cameras to enforce traffic laws instead of employing cops or even civilians to do it? Do you think that maybe this would be a good way to eliminate discriminatory policing practices while also enforcing traffic laws?
In some ways, yes. You could target things like speeding and running traffic lights. The problem, as I see it, is one of the more dangerous things people do on the road is drunk drive. And I'm not sure a traffic camera can capture that, because drunk drivers really need to be stopped when they're doing it and taken off the road immediately. But in theory, sure. If your concern is like things like driving while black, let's say that, I don't know if this is true, but let's say that black people are more likely to get speeding tickets while less likely to speed. I don't know if that's true. I'm just making that up. Then sure, you have a camera, a neutral third party as a camera. I could see that being helpful.
Yeah, totally. And so, you know, I think the idea for this task force is to have civilians monitor the roads when it comes to issues like drunk drivers. But when it comes to like running a red light or speeding, right, they would deploy these cameras, and then that would kind of help solve the racist police issue.
Sure.
Now,
yeah,
lucky for us, other cities like Chicago have already launched programs that lean on cameras to bus drivers who run red lights or to monitor speeding. And you want to know what the results were, Katie?
Yes, I would love to.
Racism! Like, I'm not kidding. So ProPublica published this lengthy article. This was back in January of 2022, January 11th. And they titled it, "Chicago's Race-Neutral Traffic Cameras Ticket Black and Latino Drivers the Most." And in it, you'll read that the cameras disproportionately ticketed Black and Latino motorists. So, Katie, please read this excerpt from the ProPublica piece.
"The coronavirus pandemic widened the ticketing disparities. Black and Latino workers have been far less likely than others to have jobs that allow them to work remotely, forcing them into their vehicles more often. In 2020, ProPublica found the ticketing rate for households in majority Black zip codes jumped to more than three times that of households in majority white areas. For households in majority Hispanic zip codes, there was an increase, but it was much smaller."
Yeah. So are you curious if the cameras were equally distributed among the neighborhoods in Chicago, regardless of racial makeup?
I am curious. Yes.
Well, they were. They were. And look, ProPublica actually touches on a really important factor here, which is to say that, you know, minorities were more likely to yes. have to go into work, whereas office workers who tend to be white were able to work from home. They had that luxury. And many of them, by the way, still do.
Yeah.
And so that was an issue. As ProPublica concedes in its reporting, motorists are monitored by cameras at close to 300 locations around Chicago, making Chicago's automated traffic enforcement program one of the largest in the country. Both red light and speed cameras were distributed roughly evenly among the city's Black, Latino, and white neighborhoods. And by the way, there were similar results in other parts of the country where they tried camera enforcement. So one example is Rochester, New York. It was actually ahead of the game. They eliminated their red light camera program in 2016 because drivers from minority and low-income neighborhoods received the most tickets.
Okay, and this, so 2016, this would have been before the pandemic. This would have been before lots of people were working at home. So presumably, white people were going into an office at the same rates as minorities, and still the minorities were getting more tickets. Is it possible that minorities are more likely to speed? Is that, has anyone considered that?
I'm going to allow the audience to interpret the data the way they choose to interpret the data. Okay. But I mean, again, the factors are different. You're right. This isn't during COVID. People are going into the office. But what I thought was really interesting was that they did away with the cameras because of the disproportionate amount of tickets
oh
that were given to people of color.
This to me is just, this is so quintessential progressive policy where you just, you basically try to paper over the problem. Like, for instance, getting rid of gifted programs in schools because there aren't enough Black and Hispanic kids in the programs. You just get rid of the thing and maybe the problem will go away.
Exactly. And it just, it's wrong. It's so wrong because it's like, okay, yeah, you know, when it comes,
it doesn't fix anything.
It doesn't fix anything at all, right? And so Culver City Schools here in LA, they decided to do away with their like honors programs because of mm-hmm. the low Latino enrollment. And I mean, my take of that is instead of doing away with honors, I think everyone, regardless of race, is capable of accomplishing incredible things. Like, help the students rise to the occasion. Like, that's the point of education. But no, let's do away with the program because
right.
it's...
Maybe people won't notice that it's racist.
Yeah,
we'll exactly. Just do away with the program.
Yeah, exactly. So, and look, and I really think that all of these police abolitionist ideas have resulted from misleading headlines about the volume of fatal police shootings, as we talked about. And in fact, like, you and Jesse have covered some of those police shootings as well, right, Katie?
Yeah, we did a deep dive into Jacob Blake. That was one. And it turned out that the narrative that spread in the immediate aftermath of this shooting was complete bullshit.
Exactly. So that's like a good example. And so, you know, there was recently one such case out of Florida that I recently debunked on TYT. It involved a drunk driver by the name of Calvin Riley. And look, I did debunk this much to the chagrin of some of our audience members, but it was really important to correct the record on it. We decided against covering it when it first broke and it went viral because I was like, listen, I have made too many mistakes in the past and I want to learn from those mistakes. Let me wait for the body cam footage to come out first. And so at first, when the story broke, highly edited body cam footage made it appear as though a cop planted a container of alcohol in his car to set him up. So when he was recently found guilty drinking and driving, people lost their minds at what they perceived to be a grave injustice.
Right, right.
But for anyone who watched the full body cam footage, as I did, you can see that no evidence was planted in his car and he was definitely driving under the influence. Like, for instance, he stopped in the middle of the road after getting pulled over for speeding. He was slurring his speech. He was placed under arrest before the police even searched his car because he was driving on a suspended license. And before the police found a sealed bottle of liquor, they actually found a tumbler in the center console that had alcohol in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have all of these details that were not initially reported and people, you know, basically went off of this highly edited video that came out and it was narrated as well, right? Like anytime you have an edited body cam video with someone narrating to you what's happening, you should question it and you should wait for more details.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is going to get more and more difficult because of AI and things like deepfake. So did you see this story? This just came out yesterday. This is a story out of Baltimore. And an athletic director at a school, at a high school, made a deepfake. He was black. He made a deepfake of the principal saying some racist shit, including about him. And then he passed it around so that this principal would be publicly shamed, which of course he was. And it turned out he made up the entire fucking thing. And in fact, he did this because the principal was investigating him for embezzling money from the school.
Oh, Mike, I did not know about that last detail about embezzling money, but I did see the story and the details about how AI was like used to generate this like fake, you know, content, making it appear as though the principal is like deeply racist. And it really scared me, Katie, because, I mean, we already have a problem, in my opinion, where people will be taken out of context or basically something very misleading will be put out there to make it appear as though someone's racist when they're really not. And I'm worried that this is going to take that pretty toxic culture and put it on overdrive.
Absolutely. It's also going to be easier to dismiss all allegations as fake or deep fake or AI or whatever, because it's going to be really hard to tell what's true and what's not. But back to LA, what do you think is going to happen here? Do you think they're going to replace the cops with social workers?
Unfortunately, there are no brakes on this car. And I think that the way this task force has been set up with activists who have already made up their minds, the fact that our city council, with the exception of one council member, is just wall-to-wall far leftists who think that police need to be abolished, all of this stuff does not bode well for the future of Los Angeles, for the future of public safety in Los Angeles. So I think that they will probably implement this program with more cameras and maybe even the unarmed civilians from the LA DOT agency, which, By the way, no one spoke to LA DOT workers to see if they're comfortable with pulling people over. So that's another thing.
Yeah, I would wonder what their union would have to say about that.
It's just a mess. So I want to say that LA is going in the direction that some of the other blue states and blue cities have been going in recently. So for instance, San Francisco, they changed some of their laws because they realized, you know, public safety actually does matter. The state of Oregon is rethinking their drug, decriminalization program.
It took so little time for actual citizens who were impacted by these policies to be like, wait a second, we didn't sign up for this. Because the other issue is that these representatives, the same thing happened in Seattle, do not actually speak for the people. And then when they come up with these policies, decriminalizing open air drug use, things like that, attempting to defund the police and public safety suffers, people vote and they end up voting for Republicans or at least conservative Democrats.
They do. That's so true. And I was hoping that my current city council member was going to be replaced with a different candidate. And unfortunately, that didn't come to fruition. She's very much on team do away with policing. It's racist and it's awful. And let's also, in fact, when it came to catalytic converter thefts, mm-hmm. her name is Nithya Raman, and she married one of the TV writers for Modern Family. So I'm guessing she's doing very well for mm-hmm. herself and is kind of insulated from some of the policies that she's putting out there. But she did not want punishment for those who are carrying out the catalytic converter thefts. She instead blamed the car companies for making the vehicles easy to steal catalytic converters from.
Right. There was a New York Times, I think it was Farhad Manju, wrote a column blaming these Asian car companies like Kia or something like that.
Right.
For making their cars too easy to steal.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the theft. It's not the thieves' fault.
No.
It's the car company.
No. The thieves are wonderful people. And if we just considered giving them homes, it'll solve everything. That's the solution.
They're just trying to afford diapers for their babies.
Exactly. Exactly. So look, overall, I don't think policing is perfect. I don't want anyone to get that, you know, perception from hearing what I'm saying on this show right now. I do think that better training and some reforms could be helpful. But at some point, without many people even realizing it, the goalpost moved to completely eliminating police from right. society little by little. And I just can't get behind that.
Once again, we live in a country with more guns than people. And unless that changes, we're going to need to rely on armed police.
I agree.
That's just how it is.
100%.
All right, Anna, well, thank you so much for this. And thank you for coming on the show. It's really good to talk to you.
Thank you, Katie. I really enjoyed it. And keep doing your thing. I love the show.
You can find Anna at The Young Turks or follow her on Twitter at Anna Kasparian. This has been Blocked and Reported. Our show is produced, as always, with help from Tracing Woodgrains and Jessica, the 80s baby. I'm Katie Herzog, and I'll be back next week with Jesse. So you better be done with that fucking book.